It just seemed really important for us to, when, you know, people know about hidden children, they don't usually think what happened after the hiding. You know, they don't wonder, you know, what if the parents perish and they're orphans now? So who do they belong to, really? They don't have parents. They don't have papers. They were stowed with this other family. Who kind of gets them? So there were all these questions I wanted to explore.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Rosner. I'm the mother of two daughters and a rescue German Shepherd. And I used to be a philosophy professor, and now I'm a novelist. And welcome to Sylvia and Me.
Jennifer, thank you so much for being here. The mother of two daughters. I have two sons. Mine are grown. You also are the author of your newest novels, Once We Were Home, and your previous one, The Yellow Bird Sings. Both, excuse me, are finalists for the National Jewish Book Award. You're also the author of a memoir, If a Tree Falls, A Family's Quest to Hear and Be Heard, and the children's book, The Mitten String, a Sydney Taylor Book Award notable. Your books have been translated into a dozen languages, and your short writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Times of Israel, the Massachusetts Review, the Forward, among others. In addition to writing, as you said, you taught philosophy. Okay, so now I want to talk about what you wrote about in your latest Once We Were Home. And, you know, the title is, you could look at it two ways. You can say, oh, you know, great, we're home already. Or you can talk about it in being something in the past and talking about once we were home. And I think that the story puts in both ends of this, both stories, because we're talking about a time during the war, during the Nazi occupation, mainly Poland, that is really not talked about, not very well known. We know that, you know, there are stories about the Holocaust. We've also recently seen movies about during that time how parents were putting their children on trains to go to safety, which was so difficult, and the children had pins on them with name tags and so on. But one of the stories that is not talked about and probably not very well known is the story that you write about in Once We Were Home, and that is the story of Jewish children who were taken by their parents to be protected by people who they knew who were empathetic to Jews, or maybe to a church. They were really Christian families or organizations where the idea was, as hard as it was, they were trying to save their children, not knowing whether they would get out alive themselves, but with the knowledge that when things were better, they would come back and get their children, if not them, then someone from their family. And we now know that this is not what happened. That for so many, these children were put in place, were in places where when it came time for the families, whether it be the parents or relatives, to come to get these children, they had a fight for them, and some had to actually be kidnapped in order to get back. Can you tell us why you even went there? I know you've studied the Holocaust and World War II, but why this particular phase? Why this story?
Yeah. So I should say, with everything I've researched, there are always many, many stories and so many variations, because almost everything imaginable seemed to happen at that time. When you start interviewing people, you realize there were so many different outcomes. But I ended up interviewing a woman who, she survived the Holocaust in a Siberian labor camp. When she returned to her village, something like just 3% of Jewish children had survived the Holocaust, and most of them were in Christian settings with assumed identities and fake names. And at this point, a lot of people were trying to flee Eastern Europe, just get out of there after the Holocaust. And there were these young survivors who joined into this mission to try to take those children with them because they didn't want to leave any Jewish people behind. That was one thing. They were trying to like rebuild this collective after all the annihilation. So there was that. There was also this feeling that the parents who had stowed their children for safety in Christian settings had meant to come back and get them back into Judaism. Like they hadn't meant for them to grow up Christian. They had hoped they would return, but then they perished. And so these young operatives thought they were honoring the sort of last wishes of these parents by taking them back into Judaism. And finally, because anti-Semitism was so strong, even right after the war, especially in Poland, but elsewhere, and the idea of leaving the children in these settings, even when like a family was loving, there were villagers, there were neighbors, there were other people, and it felt dangerous. So there were all these like feelings of a moral imperative to get those children back. So this woman joined a mission, what they called the Redemption of Jewish Children. And the word redemption is its own conversation. And there were many, many, there were kind of linguistic disagreements about what you called this, because these children had lost their first families. Their parents had stowed them in a Christian setting. Their parents had died. And now they were ensconced in this new setting, especially with families. They started to bond with them and feel like this was their home. And depending on how old the children were, some of the youngest ones felt like it was the only home they even knew. And I purposely have characters of different ages to sort of display what a different experience it might be if you're just three when you get there versus when you're seven and really do remember your past. So anyway, this woman I met was an operative. She would go in and try to retrieve them. And sometimes it was negotiation and offering of money. And when if the families refused, sometimes it was just like taking them over your shoulder and running through the fields at dusk. I mean, they would do anything to try to get these children. They felt they needed to get them. They felt they were saving them. And so as a philosopher, I think I heard that story and I thought, you know, there is some version of saving Judaism in there, but for each individual child, it's not clear what that must have been like. I mean, some of them, it was just an additional terrible emotional rupture because they had attached to this new family and now they were being taken away from that. And I was interested in the psychology of it and what it does to a child's sense of self and identity and faith and belonging and all these kinds of questions. And I decided to weave it together with some different stories of children who are moved in very different ways, but who also undergo these same kinds of questions in their development after that kind of movement.
Well, as you said, you did put in characters. There are four main children that you talk about of different ages. And one that I'd like to take a look at to begin with is a brother and sister. The brother is three. The sister is seven, if I'm not mistaken. Their names originally were Mira and Danielle. Daniel, and they go through something absolutely horrific. The three-year-old doesn't remember, but the seven-year-old does. And as you said, it's, you know, they're placed with a family who the mother sort of knows, a Christian family, with the idea that she will come back for her children. And you have in there the two characters where this sister knows her family, can't understand why her mother has done this. And the brother, who's three, doesn't remember, but the sister has promised her mother that she will take care of her brother, that she will make her brother safe. And the first thing, as you said, that their identity, they immediately have to have different names because they can't have Jewish names. And she has to protect her little brother because he can't go swimming or changing in front of Christian other boys because he's been circumcised. I mean, there's so many different things that go on and the tug of war right there. Why did you put a family like that together? You know, their names were changed. You have one sibling who remembers and one sibling who does not. How did you manage to weave that in?
Yeah, well, it just seemed really important for us to, when, you know, people know about hidden children, they don't usually think what happened after the hiding. You know, they don't wonder, you know, what if the parents perish and they're orphans now? So who do they belong to, really? They don't have parents. They don't have papers. They were stowed with this other family. Who kind of gets them? So there were all these questions I wanted to explore, but also how does it feel to be a child like this who's been moved first for their safety and then later to be back in Judaism, this kind of thing? How does it feel? And I wanted to explore the complexity of it. I don't think there is one single story. So I at least was able to make these two kind of really different scenarios with memory, with age, and even with the formation of relationships. Like, it's much easier for Oscar to form a relationship with this rescue family in Poland than it is for his sister, who remembers her parents, hopes they're coming back, and almost feels like it would be a betrayal to become close to this other family. Like, she's trying to kind of hold herself for her parents, kind of, like, and not sink into a daughterly relationship with this new family, because when her mom comes back, you know, that kind of thing. So I think children did feel that kind of guilt or shame or ambivalence. I mean, they had all kinds of feelings that they were dealing with. Plus, they were tamping down their identity. So they couldn't speak Yiddish. They had to only speak formal Polish. They, you know, they had to never slip up about their name, and most especially hints like the circumcision, et cetera. So there was a lot of pressure on children who were in hiding. It was very stressful. And, you know, they were vigilant, and it was, you grew old quickly. That 7-year-old, you know, is no 7-year-old that we would recognize, you know, and she couldn't be. And Oscar was luckier in a way to be younger. And she sometimes resents that because, you know, for him, he's just kind of going through his new life here without all the kind of heaviness of memory and even awareness. Whereas when you're a little bit older, you have to deal. And in wartime, that's what children go through.
And it's not just another identity that they have. It's not just a name change. It's not just covering the fact that, you know, there's certain Jewish rituals or whatever. They went to church. And you have another young man who actually, at the age of 7, where is he? He's in a monastery. So what we don't think about is what happens to these children as far as not only their identity, but they're trying to be true to who they are, and how are they going to figure out who they are? These are stories that are not, they're not really known. We're not told about them. And when I mentioned Roger, they went even further because where he was at the monastery, there was a sister who just believed that God was going to save him, and the only way to save him was to baptize him. And baptize him, and he was questioning that in his mind, because one of the things was, are there really roads to good and evil? And Roger thinks to himself, why did my parents take the wrong road, which is what he was told? Can I really be saved if they weren't? You're talking a 7-year-old.
Yeah. And, you know, the case of Roger is loose. It's a totally fictionalized character who's loosely based on a case, a true case of these brothers who were, they were hidden in a convent. When actually surviving aunts did, come to try to take him into their family after the war, the church, you know, baptized them and took them on the run and like would not give them back. They were considered kidnapped children, and there were court orders, and clergy went to jail. And I mean, it was like a big crazy thing. And there was a scholar at Brown who studied this case, who actually went to the archives, like as soon as they opened, and found that the order to keep those children within the church went very high up in the papacy. Like they did not want to return, especially baptized children, to Judaism. But also they baptized them after the war because they wanted to save his soul, their soul. And so that's the thing too, is that you're dealing with people, all of whom have these beliefs that they feel very strongly about, that they feel righteous about. And it's moving them to do certain things with children according to their own sort of sense of ideology and religion, et cetera. And meanwhile, the children are somewhat caught up in the whole situation and they're struggling with faith. And Roger is asking, like, who does a soul belong to? And how do I pray for, I'm praying to this God now. And then, you know, then he's there later with his aunt in Israel praying to that God. You know, it's so confusing when you think about it from a child's point of view. And it's like they're just being moved around by adults who have their sense of what should be for these children.
And we don't think about the child's point of view. We don't think about what they suffered. You know, we talk about PTSD these days. These children suffered it on a regular basis. Maybe once they were trying to figure out one identity that they were given, then all of a sudden that was ripped from them. And now there's another identity and they don't, they want to be loyal to who? They don't know.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is who they're connected to at the time, you know, and it, and then they get taken from that person or put with this other person, and they're trying to please that person or try to accommodate what they're asking for of them, and it's very hard. I mean, these children suffered a lot, and you know, when I read some of the testimony of. In the case of the earlier brother sibling, this brother and sister pair, the operatives who managed to get Jews out of Christian settings into Israel, into kibbutzim, you know, one of the people who was an operative who moved these children, he followed them over the course of their lives. And he had a lot of retrospective questions and or regrets about it, thinking that maybe for some people they rerouted and they made a good life and it worked out okay. And for others, they just struggled terribly and had psychic damage, really, from all this movement and kind of the switching around and the and he wondered if it really was what they should have done, even though at the time they felt sure it was. They really felt clear that it was the moral and, you know, right thing to do. So I think that's really interesting for us to always think about how sometimes we're so certain. And then later, when we've been able to really evaluate it, it's less clear, right? So that kind of insistent righteousness is somewhat something to be questioned, I think.
Well, you know, this was at a time where for a lot of them, when this started, Israel wasn't statehood yet, so yeah. They not only were taken from the situation that they were in that was going to save them. Now they're going to they're on boats going to the land that is supposed to totally accept them and start all over, and they are forced to wait. In conditions that are not exactly fantastic. And then they get there and now they're given another name.
Exactly. Right. And a lot of boats got rerouted by the British, you know, British mandated Palestine at the time was not letting in all these sort of what you might call refugees at the time. They were turned back. They ended up in Cyprus in these camps at length, you know, sometimes for a couple of years. And then finally after, you know, the war of independence there, they ended up getting in and going on a kibbutz. And again, you're right, their names were changed again. So it was like yet another kind of, I don't know, challenge to sense of self and identity. And you might think a name is just this sort of, you know, superficial thing, a nominal thing, as we call a name, right? But you know, for a young child who's had all these different changes and what they're supposed to, you know, believe in, and are they supposed to go to synagogue or to church, and are they with this family or where are their parents, and all these kinds of questions that are asking. I mean, I think that the lack of rootedness is very hard. You know, the feeling that you're just kind of, you know, it's hard to figure out how to take root.
And these are stories, again, I know that there's an estimated 200,000 Polish children who were kidnapped during the war for Germanization. But this is a little bit different because this is what we're talking about is children who were placed for their safety by their loved ones, by their parents who were hoping to be able to come back and get them and always had that hope. And so as these children are rescued or brought or whatever, however you want to call it, now they're searching for anyone from their family. You know, the women you interviewed, you know, there were only so many records of where these children originated, what was their birth name, who were their parents, what happened to their family, and hopefully connect them with where they are presently in order to get them, to bring them to any relative, or to really get the Jewish community back together again. So many had been killed that their, you know, process, what they were thinking was the saving of as many Jews as possible out of the horrific, you know, of the Holocaust.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really important, the distinction you make, because I do also weave in a story of a child who's been Germanized, and that is a completely different situation. But what it is an example of another way children were moved during wartime in the Holocaust era, you know. So it was totally different than the Jewish children who had been stowed for their safety and then moved back either for Judaism or to try to get reunited with family. In the case of Renata, the fourth child in my story, she's a non-Jewish Polish girl who's taken from a park by Nazi soldiers for Germanization, which was a program also that I hadn't really known a lot about, despite having studied this period for a while. Where it turned out Himmler had this particular program, and it was very fascinating because, you know, the birth rate in Germany was low, men were off at war, and for a people who cared so much about racial purity, it's kind of odd, but they ended up rounding up children, in adjacent countries who could pass the tests of the calipers and the hair charts and eye colors and be Aryan looking enough that they could be put into Germanization centers, re-educated as German. And for some kids, adopted into childless German couples' homes and raised as Germans. And so this is a whole nother sort of segment of how children got moved in wartime. And I was interested in this too, because we keep moving children. Russian soldiers have moved Ukrainian children. There's a whole line of, you could weave together 20 cases of different times where people are moving children for some purpose. In this case, you know, the Nazis building up the German population, very different than the case of either Jews trying to reclaim the remaining Jewish children after the war, or even the church who was trying for the salvation of children to keep them within the Christian fold. This is a whole nother movement of children. And I just felt like by weaving them all together, I was making a statement about adults and ideology and how we move children. And even if the situations are totally different, and even if you can't draw any moral equivalency with respect to what the adults are doing, the equivalencies exist for the children because they're all struggling with who they are, where they belong, what is home, you know, how to have faith, you know, et cetera. So that's that.
And that's something, as you said, you mentioned, you know, the Ukrainian children being taken by Russia. We know about separations of families and still can't get some of these children back together. This is a story that needs to be out there because people don't understand. And it's so, it's not a well-known story, whether it's because people are embarrassed to talk about it, people don't want to hear about it. But children are so, they're so, we have to be careful how we treat our children. And there's so many, they're smarter than we think. they know more and understand more than we think. And they're just not pawns to be moved. And during the war, they were pawns to be moved, whether out of love and respect or out of some god-awful organization that they wanted to, you know, a new birthing and repopulation. But we do not give the children the intelligence that they need, the emotional stability that they need and desire. And it's something in your background, you are bringing out to the forefront that, yes, millions and millions of Jews were killed. They were annihilated. And the children who survived under such, under hidden circumstances, you know, we have our own reasons for doing things, but we don't think about those children.
Yeah. And I purposely narrated the novel from the children's points of view for this, because I thought now you will relate to it from within the child's mind, from behind their eyes, what they see when they're going through this, what they think and feel when they're going through this, so that it really would bring to life a child's experience of this situation. Because you could write about this from a nonfiction standpoint, or you could write about it from the adult's point of view, but we need to have the child's points of view to understand the struggle that they're really undergoing when they're, you know, with these types of movements in history.
Exactly. And for young people today to understand it, and for adults to really understand it and maybe realize where, you know, how children think and how identity is so important. And I don't want to sound trivial about it. We, you know, this was a time in history that needs to be remembered. This is a time in history that, in places, as we talked about, is being repeated. You know, I'm thinking about children who are in blended families. You know, a name means something. So to actually think about what these children went through during the war and then after the war, you know, during the war, you're, as adults, you're waiting for something to happen. You're waiting for the war to end. And then the war ends and the children are supposedly now safe. And, you know, reuniting them with their families is wonderful, but we have to think about how they got there and how we're going to take care of them going forward, the psychological effects and how do you deal with that? And it wasn't really known back then. Nothing was really known. Again, PTSD wasn't a thing. And so everyone had, you know, bringing them back into their families and bringing them back into Judaism. It was done with the right intentions. The unfortunate thing was that nobody knew really how to deal with the children emotionally.
Yeah. And also, you know, many of them had been orphaned. And so they weren't actually going to go home. They weren't going to their family. They were going to Judaism, which is conceptual. And so they'd end up maybe in a children's home, or they'd end up in a kibbutz and they'd find a community, but it wasn't their family. And even when it was their family, it could be very hard. Those reunifications were so complicated if the child didn't remember. And it was also hard because you know, during the war, to be Jewish was so dangerous that you were told to never mention anything. And then afterward, someone says, oh, no, we're taking you back and you're Jewish. And the child would burst into tears. It's like very confusing. And, you know, they don't know the top story necessarily. You know what I mean? And so, yeah, so it was really traumatic. And you're right there. I mean, there are scholars now who really study children of the war, memory, trauma, you know, all kinds of things. But at the time, you know, there were just these pushes and pulls. You know, we try to regroup, we try to move forward, we try to get every Jewish child back in. We try, you know, they were just trying to kind of patch up after this terrible thing. But I think it was just still really important to note that this was incredibly hard for children, who, especially those who had been in these settings and were being reclaimed under various conditions.
I love how you brought all four children together. And we have to say that, you know, we started off, the children were, we know about the brother and sister, they were 3 and 7. We know about Roger, who was about 7. I believe we meet Renata basically when she's older. But I love how you bring them all together. Each one has a different story on as to how they got there. You have a very moving way of bringing them all together at the end. So I won't give away the story, but it is quite moving and beautiful. And it shows how resilient love is, and being able to accept certain things and get some questions answered, which is so important. If you had one thing that you want people to take away from reading this book, what would that be?
I think it would be to take a lot of care to understand that, you know, connection really matters. And while we might, you know, think sort of in a heady type of way about where a child might be better off here or better off there, it's better to stop and wonder, like, who is this child connected to? Where is the love in that child's life? You know, what really is the best setting for a child before we go around making decisions about where they belong, you know? And I think that, you know, just after the war, no one had the luxury of this. There was a desperation, and they just needed to regroup. But from a child's perspective, these are the things that really are important. And we adults need to stop and really give that its due.
Jennifer, where can people find out more about you and what you've been doing, your books?
I have a website. It's my name, Jennifer Rosner, but there's a dash between the two. So jennifer-rosner.com. And there's a lot of info on the website. There's events I'm doing. There's, you know, information about each book, et cetera. So I'd love for people to visit that.
Jennifer, I want to thank you for bringing this story to light, because as we said at the very beginning, it's not one that's really known and talked about. And it's a story that should never be forgotten, and hopefully never be repeated, unfortunately, as we talked about. But I thank you for talking to me today and being here.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Thank you for joining me today. If you liked what you heard, please share it with another person you think would be interested. And if you haven't already, please subscribe.
This has been a Life of Prey production.